Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is an Our Paranormal Afterlife classic episode, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. I've been thinking about a few standout episodes from the early days of the podcast. They're full of great information, and I thought it would be a good idea to share them again for listeners who may have missed them the first time around. This particular episode dates back to 2018. My guest is Robert Snow, and I'm talking to him about his book, Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic: The True Story of a Police Detective's Reincarnation. Well, Robert, thank you very much for coming onto the Past Lives podcast. It's very kind of you to give us your time.
I appreciate you asking.
First of all, could you tell us about your career in the police and how that started?
Well, yeah, I just became a police officer by accident. I really never had any intention growing up or anything to be a police officer. I was in the military during the Vietnam War, and after I was discharged, I got home. I was just looking for a job. Well, my brother was a police officer at the NAS Police Department, and of course, this is during, I got out in 1968, and the war was still, I did my 4 years, but the war was still going on, so there weren't a whole lot of young men available to serve in the police department, so they were really looking for people. My brother suggested, well, come on down, they're hiring, and I needed a job, and I just went down and stayed there for 38 years. It was just one of those things I just think I just fell into, and it turned out to be a great, because only thing I'd ever really wanted to be in my life was a writer. I never wanted to be anything else. From my earliest memories, all I ever wanted to be was a writer. But being in police work really helped me, because not only did it give me a good career with a lot of, stable income, but also gave me a lot of things to write about. And I've got 18 books in print, and all of them are about police work. So it gave me really a good basis to work from.
Yeah, it sounds like you get tons of material from the job. Yeah, you're working a homicide.
Yeah, I was a captain at the Dance Police Department. I was in charge of homicide for a number of years. And that, of course, that is a lot of information, because I write a number of true crime books and a number of interesting cases while I was at the police department. So it really proved invaluable, that the job. It really did. I was very fortunate to kind of fall into it, because it's nice to think about being a writer, but the making money and being a writer are not the same thing for the majority of writers. You just don't make it really, most of them. I mean, you hear about the odd cases, people make millions of dollars, but believe me, that don't happen for most writers. So you don't make that enough to really live on. So having another job like that, and technically having a job with a lot of interesting things that you can write about, was very fortuitous for me.
What was your view of reincarnation when you were in the police before any of this started?
It came as just, I don't know, just, it was just kind of a falling into thing. I always want to be a writer, and so I wrote 18 books. I also wrote, I had over 100 articles and short stories published in national magazines. But if you're a writer, to be a writer, you also have to be a reader. You just can't write. You also have to read. You have to read from every field, not just your own field. You have to read from every field. You basically see how other writers handle things. They handle something really well. You want to analyze it and see how they did it so you can do it. If they handle something really bad, you want to look at it, make sure you don't do that. So I've always been a very voracious reader. At one time, I belonged to a whole lot of book clubs. So one time, one of the book clubs offered a book. It was called Coming Back by a Dr. Raymond Moody. Dr. Moody was a physician, but he was doing research on near-death experiences. Well, he had a friend who was a psychologist, and she did past life regression therapy. Of course, past life regression therapy is basically what the last resort for people who have ailments that can't be explained. There's a person who will have maybe a terrible pain in their elbow, and they go see the doctor, they do MRIs and all, and they can't find anything. And they can't cure it. For the last resort, they'll send to a past life regression therapist. What this person does is hypnotize them and basically take them to a past life. And interestingly enough, they almost always go to the past life where they suffered an injury to their elbow. And basically, just going through it again, reliving it, will stop the pain. It's a very effective mechanism. Now, I've talked to a lot of psychologists, and psychologists use it. Most of them believe that the illness is psychosomatic, and so is the cure. Most of them don't believe you really go back to a past life. They just believe that you have a psychosomatic illness, and so this is a psychosomatic cure that seems to work. So anyway, in the book, Dr. Moody talked about, his friend talked him into doing past life regression, and she took him back to 8 past lives. She hypnotized him about 8 past lives, and It was a really interesting book, well written, and he describes all his lives. But at the end, the last chapter, he basically says, yeah, I don't know what this is. I'm not really sure. Is there anything true or subconscious memories being brought back up through hypnosis? And that was basically the way I thought about it. But it's very interesting, but there's nothing real about it. It's just your subconscious mind taking old memories and crafting them into a story. And so I just basically forgot about it when on the other reading. Well, months later, I was at a party at the police department. My wife is a police detective also, and she worked in child abuse. And the Child Advocacy Center here in Indianapolis was having a party. And so naturally, I accompanied her to her. Well, I was making chit-chat with one of the ladies there who's a psychologist at the Indianapolis Police Department. And we were just making chit-chat. I'd talk about movies we'd see and everything. And start talking about books you read. And I remembered this book. And so I mentioned to her that I read the book. Now, at this time, I didn't realize that this lady, the psychologist, actually, she used past life regression therapy herself. I didn't know that, but she asked me what I thought about the book. I thought it was all bull. I thought this is just people making up stories. People who want to find excuses for their bad life now, saying it's bad karma from a previous life type thing. And people with wishful thinking want not believe they're ever going to die, that they'll come back type thing. The problem was it was getting late in the party, and I'd had a bit to drink, and I think I was kind of obnoxious, to tell you the truth. And she was real nice. Kathy Graben is the lady's name. She was very nice about it, basically down to the point where she said, well, if you think it's silly, why don't you try it and see if? And at first I said, no, I'm not doing that. It's stupid. But anyway, I got in the back. Oh, you're scared, are you? Hey, you don't want to ask a man if he's scared, especially if you've been drinking and all. You're going to say no. So anyway, I ended up basically saying, okay, I'd try it, sure, how stupid it was. Well, so I agreed to do a past life regression. Well, the next day, being more clear-headed, I said, I ain't doing that. That's stupid. But the problem was, every day I'd run into Kathy, and she asked me, because she'd give me the name of a psychologist she knew who did the past life regression for me to contact. And it seemed like I'd run to her every day. And she'd say, well, have you made the appointment yet? Have you done it? And I'd always have some kind of little feeble excuse. I had to meet two meetings and this, and I'm going to. Now, before this, I don't think I ran into her once a month. It seemed like after I'd run to her every day and be like, oh, God, there she is again. And you got another feeble excuse after another. Well, I finally got out. I got tired of that because you almost want to run out. You see her, you want to head down the stairway, get away from her. I thought, this is stupid. So I basically called the lady, Dr. Mary Ellen Griffith, and made an appointment. I said, well, I'm not. But my point was, I told Dr. Griffith I'd like to bring a recorder along and record it. She said, no problem. So I kind of wanted, I was going to go there. I was going to cooperate with Dr. Griffith 100%. But I want a recording of it so I come back and show Kathy how stupid it was that it wouldn't work. And that's basically how I got talked into doing it.
So what was your experience of hypnosis like?
Well, when I went into Dr. Griffith's office, really nice lady, very nice lady, very, very, very gracious, welcomed me and all, very nice. And, she asked me whether I had any problems that I wanted to work with. I said, no, I just thought that past night hypnosis was interesting. I'd like to try it. She didn't have any problems. She said, no problem at all. So she said, sit down on the couch. In front of her nursing office, looks just like I thought a psychologist always looked like. I had an old wooden desk and a big long couch. I guess you could lay on if you want to. I didn't. I just sat down. We did and basically talked for a few minutes. She was very, very nice. Like, she had a kind of funny, kind of musical, sing-songy type voice, very soothing, sing-songy, musical type voice. But anyway, we just started talking and everything. And she finds, okay, is you ready? Close your eyes. So I pulled my hands on my lap, and I closed my eyes, and I say, okay, give me some details about your college graduation. Tell me about it. Just tell me, give me some details about it. So I did, and she said, okay, now tell me about an incident in high school that happened to you. And so then I did that too. Then she went to grade school, and I could see what she's doing. I was thinking at the moment she wouldn't be a very good interrogator because you knew where she's going. Anybody can know what questions you're going to ask next can prepare for them. But anyway, she kept getting older and older memories to try and find one to get in my earliest childhood memory. And I tried to give her what I thought it was and all that. So anyway, so fine. She said, okay, so are you ready to start? I said, yep. So she said, okay. She says, can you see a balloon? I said, imagine a balloon in your head. Just imagine a balloon. And actually, I could. I could see a big purple blob. But I knew it was the sun coming through the window on my right. I knew where it was. With a big purple blob in my eyes closed. And I told her, yeah, I see a balloon, it's purple. I said, okay. She says, now, I want you to get into the balloon. She says, imagine yourself taking off. So, I've decided I'm going to cooperate 100% with Dr. Griffith, but I wanted it all recorded so I could go back later and show Kathy how foolish it all was, and that there was nothing to it. So anyway, she said, okay, sis, so we got in the balloon here. And she says, look down, can you see anything below? And interesting enough, it looked to me that I could, by my eyelids, I got like lights down below. But I figured it was just reflection off the floor. I didn't think it was anything important, reflection off the floor. So anyway, she said, okay, sis, now let's take the balloon down. We're going to land, you're going to see where you're at. Well, nothing really happened. I mean, I was thinking to myself, this is her daydream, not mine. So we must have went through this thing at least a dozen times. Take the balloon down, but nothing happened. I mean, I wasn't going to make up something just for her. If I saw somebody, I told her, but I certainly wasn't going to make something up. And she finally said, okay, there's control over your head, reach up and pull it down, bring it down. Well, nothing happened. We went through this, like I said, she was awful patient because we went through this at least a dozen times. And nothing happened. And again, I wasn't going to make up anything. I wasn't going to try and invent anything. Is that, you know, for her. I decided to cooperate, but I wasn't going to invent anything. Finally, she seemed very gracious about the whole thing. Very nice. I said, okay. So now see if you can imagine a mountain in your mind. And I'd been there, sitting there by this time, probably 20 minutes with my hands full of my lap, my eyes closed. And it's you know, just my couch is the hardest couch I'd ever seen in my life. Everything was aching on me right now. And for some reason, I could see a mountain. And it was really clear in my mind. But I knew it was still a daydream, imagination, but boy, it looked clear. She said, okay, I'll take the balloon over, land on the mountain. So I said, okie dokie. I'm trying to cooperate. She said, now get off and you'll see there's a cabin here. And again, funny thing, I could imagine a cabin, but when I saw it, the logs were going vertical rather than horizontal. I later found out, when my readers later told me, that's the French way of building a log cabin. At the time I didn't know it, I just thought it was kind of odd. I could see it going vertical rather than horizontal. So anyway, she said, go inside. What do you see? Well, I didn't see nothing. I mean, again, this is her daydream, not mine. I thought, I don't see anything. She said, okay, now imagine it's bright and there's lots of food there and everything. Okay, you know, so I tried to do that. I'm being cooperative. But okay. She said, now we're done. She says, we're going to walk down to the valley. There's a valley here. There's 12 steps. And I want you to walk down the 12 steps. And I said, okay, again, I'm trying to imagine. I'm trying to be cooperative, and I imagine this. But anything, she starts counting. And she does 12, 11. And her voice is getting longer. And she said, I mean, it's almost like, I thought, God, this is crazy. At the time, I'm thinking, this, Bob, you're an idiot. What are you doing here? This is so foolish. She says, you know, 9, 8. You can't count down. Well, it's enough, when she got to 1, something really bizarre happened, or really bizarre. All of a sudden, I was in the valley. I mean, I wasn't imagining I was in a valley. I wasn't just seeing a vision of it. I was there. And I knew I was still in the office. I could feel the couch. My buttocks still hurt. And I still had my hands folded in my lap. But at the same time, I was in a valley. It was just as clear as regular vision. I was walking along a path in this valley, and I could see the veins on leaves of bushes. So I could see the veins in the leaves. There was a breeze blowing. I could feel it blowing my face. Now, I assumed it was just the air conditioning in the office. But I could see the wind blowing. I could feel it. And at the time, I knew what this was. I mean, I wasn't stupid. I figured, all right, Bob, you've been hypnotized. This is a hypnosis. You're under hypnosis. That's all there is to it. This is nothing real. It's not real. You know, it's not a real vision. You're simply hypnotized. You are. That's funny, because before I went there, I really didn't think I could be hypnotized. I really thought I was too strong. But there it was. So anyway, I told her, I'm in a valley. And I described the valley to her, but it was a really steep-sided valley. And I'm walking along to the next little brook, a little brook walking along there. Again, I can still feel the breeze in my face. And so she asked me to describe myself. I looked down. I can see a pair of really dirty, gnarly-looking feet and legs. I'm wearing some kind of really dirty, matted fur. Everybody, now, not my left hand, I was carrying like a big tree limb. Now, everybody knows what this is. Everybody's seen that movies and TV program by cavemen. I knew what this is supposed to be. But again, I thought this is just my subconscious mind playing tricks on me. And I described myself to her, and I described the valley and everything. Then suddenly, it was really odd. So I started saying things before I knew I was going to say them. And Bob Snow didn't know where this place was, but in the body I was in, he recognized the place, because I told her I live up on the hill. There's a cave on top of the hill, apparently, which is where I live. And I didn't really know I was going to say that. Kind of surprised me. I just said it without knowing it. So Dr. said, okay, go to the cave. Well, we had to walk to the cave, but just kind of like it was like kind of a gray fog. And next thing you know, I'm standing in front of the mouth of the cave. And I walk in, and there's this terrible, terrible odor. This guy was not very hygienic. I mean, this was really, the cave really, and I couldn't, I was trying, I'm sitting in this cafe, where did this come from? I could smell this really odor of this guy, again, was not very hygienic. So anyway, well, I'm describing the cave to her. She said, okay. She said, now go to your death. She says, go to your death. Tell me what you see. So again, there was like 2 or 3 minutes of gray fog. I didn't see anything. And next thing, I'm not in the body any longer. I'm kind of floating about 7 or 8 feet above it. And I can see a little skinny man wrapped in fur laying on the cave floor. And he's just coughing. And it looked like it was a really, really painful coughing. I'm not sure what he's dying of, but it doesn't look real pleasant. So I described Dr. Griffin. She said, okay, now go out of here. She says, and what'd you go out of the cave? So I went out of the cave. She said, what'd you learn from this life? And again, I started answering before I could even think what I was going to say. I didn't know I was going to say it. I just told her this was a bad life because I was all alone. I didn't have anybody. I didn't have anybody at all. I was all alone. And she said, okay. She says, now, can you see a light? And I looked up, and sure enough, there's a light above the valley, a real bright light above. She said, go into the light. I said, I want you to go back to a life where you did have someone. So next thing you know, I'm in the light, and there's about 3 or 4 seconds of gray fog. Again, this whole time, this is sort of like to me, like if you go to Disney World or some big amusement park, they have some really great rides that seem terribly realistic. They really do. But you know they're not. If you're in some ride, you're not really falling or you're not really, going to crash or anything, but it feels like it. That's what I thought this was. It was like a virtual reality thing where it really looked very real, but you knew it wasn't. You knew this is all in your mind. But I was really enjoying it because, interesting enough, before the session, Dr. Griff had warned me about, there's a white light around you protecting you from anything you see. And I'd been a police officer for a long time before this, and I didn't really think I was going to see anything during a session. It really scared me. But she's kept warning me that you're going to be protected, nothing can get to you. I'm just thinking, whatever. And again, I wasn't scared by this at all. I thought it was just fascinating. It was just a really interesting, interesting event. So I was just going to enjoy it. So anyway, she said, I want you to go to a life where you had someone. So there's about 4 or 5 seconds, probably a gray fog. And then all of a sudden, I see myself, I'm walking along a street in a very large city. The interesting part was, it was a sunny day and I could feel the sun beating down on me. Now I'm in a closed, darkened office. I thought, how bizarre. I thought this was really bizarre, that I could feel the sun. And she asked me to look at myself. I'm dressed very well. I told her I have a cane. I said, but it's not a real cane. It's a walking stick, a fancy walking stick. And I looked around, and I could tell it looked to me like the late 1800s, because there was a lot of tall buildings and all, but the street lights were gas, and there was horse-drawn carriages going up down the street. So I figured it must look like the 1800s sometime. And I described all this to Dr. Griffiths. She said, okay. She says, now, where are you going to? And again, I didn't know what I was going to say. Before I knew it, the words come fly out of my mouth. I told her, I'm going to meet a woman. And she asked me, I said, okay, go meet her. Tell us what happened. So I met this woman, and we went to an outdoor cafe. And doctor says, well, what did you order? I said, she ordered some kind of special water. And I ordered a glass of wine. And doctor says, okay. She says, go forward 5 years to your next seat. So again, I got a few seconds of fog. And all of a sudden, I'm standing in a hallway of an apartment building, and I'm having this real vigorous argument with someone, with a woman. We're having this really vigorous argument, and suddenly I just turn and walk away, walk down the hall, and into a room, and I could see it was an artist studio. It was an easel set up. There were just dozens of paintings hanging on the walls. And again, like with the caveman, knowing and recognizing the valley and knowing where he lived, I instantly knew right then that this is where I worked, that I was a painter. Again, I told Dr. Griffith that I'm in this studio, and I described the studio to her. Had one whole wall of windows and skylights, and then I told her about all the paintings and the easel and everything that was in there. And again, I knew I was a painter. So she said, "Okay." She said, "We said now go to your death." I said, "Tell me what happens." And I could see myself laying on like a bed, and I'm dying. And then suddenly I see myself rise out of the body and go through the ceiling of this building. Now everybody, again, has seen ghost movies and ghost programs on TV. Everybody knows the ghosts always do that. They go up through the ceiling as you're just a spirit. So anyway, when I go above the building, and I can see it's nighttime, and I'm in the midst of a huge, huge city. It looked like lights to all horizons where I'm at. It's just a huge, huge city. So Dr. Griffin says, well, what did you regret about this life? And I told her, I regret that we didn't have any children because my wife couldn't have children. Again, I'm saying these things for all I know what I'm going to say. I haven't, my mouth is like a runaway horse. It just gallop away on its own. So I'm just saying this. I said, we didn't have children. I wanted to have children. So she said, okay, now go into the light. But interesting enough, you know, people always get the idea that if you're being hypnotized, that you're under the control of the hypnotist. And you're really not. You're really not. You know exactly what's going on around you because you always see the stage hypnosis. They can cluck like a chicken and all. And that's bull. Because during the hypnosis, I knew exactly what was going on. Now, I'd say things before I knew I was going to say them. But anyway, Dr. Griff told me to go into the light. Well, I didn't do it. Even though she told me to go in the light, I didn't. I saw myself flying through some woods. I could tell it looked like fall, late fall, because it looked like it was a cold, brisk evening, but the trees all still had their leaves on them. So anyway, I'm flying through this forest, and all of a sudden, I'm at this home. I'm on the second or third, I'm looking in the window on the second or third floor of this home. And there's a painting, a still life painting. There's nobody in the room, but there's a big fire in the fireplace. There's still life painting above the fireplace. And it was a still life. It had the bottles and fruit and a big sun in it. And I told Dr. Griffith, I wanted to see one of my paintings before I left the earth. I wanted to see one of my paintings for one last time. So anyway, so she said, okay. She said, okay, now. She kept trying to keep me going to light. I wouldn't do it until I got this done. That's what the part about people don't think you're really under control of hypnotists because I didn't listen to her. Well, you know, what she kept saying it, but I wouldn't do it. I did my own thing. So anyway, she said, okay, now I want you to go back to a life you had as a female. I thought, yeah, that's going to happen. Sure. So anyway, it did. So anyway, they go through a little bit of fog, and all of a sudden I find myself in a young girl's body. And I don't know where I'm at. I'm in the woods, but it wasn't the woods of the caveman. It's a different type of trees, and it was all level land, but some trees. And I'm standing in front of it. It looked like a big, gigantic monument. There was a circle, a pillar. It's a big monument circle with pillars around the edge. And again, Dr. Griffith, you know, asked me, you know, what do you see? And she asked me to describe myself. And I just saw myself as looked like a teenage girl. And she said, what are you doing? And again, my mouth come to words. I said, this is where I work. I bring things down to the altar. And again, I told her new things about this life I ain't thinking. And I told her that, there's a bunch of girls who work here. We all work here. But you had to be pretty and you had to be a virgin to work here. So Dr. said, okay. And I explained to her, you know, the things we do there. So Dr. said, okay, go ahead 5 years in your life. So all of a sudden, 5 years later, I see my mom come back after the Great Fog. I'm in a big wagon being driven by an ox. I look to my left. There's a much older man sitting next to me. Like an elderly man sitting next to me. And I knew again, how I knew, and that the body I was in knew that I had been given to this, or either sold or given to this man by the temple, by the place I was working, because I had gotten pregnant. And obviously, if you're supposed to have to be a virgin working there, that's not going to go along with that. So I looked to my right, and there's a little girl sitting there. I instantly knew in that life that was my little girl. That was my little girl. But the interesting part is it was something I recognized my present life. It was my stepdaughter in my present life. But not the age of this. At the time I had the regression therapy, she was like 16 and going to high school. Well, this was a little girl the same age she was when I married her mother. And I thought that was the only person I recognized. I thought I recognized her from that life, you know, as being her. So anyway, what happened, the guy that gave me to, the old man that gave me to, didn't live very long at all. He died real soon after I got there. And so I took my daughter back to the temple where I'd worked and basically gave her away to him. I knew that it'd be much easier for me that I'd have a little 3 or 4 year old child hanging on. And so I went back and gave her up to this so they could, you know, she could work at a temple and left. And then I went to a village or a town by the ocean where I got a job doing something to do with fish. Because Dr. Griffith told me, he said, okay, now go to your death. And with my death, I got caught up in a net and I was drowning and I could taste salt water. At the moment, I thought how bizarre that was. I could taste salt water. I was drowning. So anyway, that doctor says, okay, now go to the light. But the whole time I'm doing this, I'm trying to explain to Dr. Griffith why I gave my daughter up to the temple. And I'm trying to make it sound like I did a really good thing. It was the best thing for her and I'd done her a favor. But all the time, I felt this terrible guilt. And I thought, at the time, thinking how stupid to do it. This is all dream stuff. This is all makeup stuff. But I felt this terrible weight on me, like this terrible guilt, because I know what I'd really done is abandon my daughter to make my life easier. And so Dr. said to go to the light. I went pretty quick. I really didn't want to stay in that line because I had this terrible, terrible guilt feeling for giving my daughter up. So anyway, Dr. said, okay, so I want you to go back to your most previous past life. Go back to the life you were before you were Bob Snow. So again, I go into the light and there's mold, maybe 4 or 5 seconds of gray. And all of a sudden I come back in the body and I knew immediately I'm back in the painter's body again. But this time I'm standing by easel and I'm painting a portrait. But interesting enough, the portrait is of a hunchback woman. See, I'm just now finishing the painting. I'm just putting the last brushstrokes on the painting, and I can see the painting clear, vividly clear. I could see every brushstroke in the painting. But I thought how bizarre to paint the portrait of a hunchback woman. So anyway, so Dr. Griffith asked what I'm doing. I'm telling her, and I told her I hate painting portraits. I just hate it, but I need the money. And I could feel this person had a desperate need for money. This person just really, really could. This money was what was important about it. So she said, okay, now you gotta go back to go 5 years ahead. So I went 5 years ahead. Now I was at a party, and I don't know what it was for, but everybody was congratulating me. Everybody was saying, congratulating me, patting on the back type thing. I didn't know what it was for, but I was obviously the star of the party, and everybody's congratulating me for some achievement. Again, I don't know what it was, but it was something really important. So anyway, she takes me to the various scenes of life. And between one of the scenes, all of a sudden I had this thing, I blurred this out. I said, she died of a blood clot. The doctor said she died of a blood clot. And I had no idea who I was talking about. I had no idea who this person was, but I knew it was a woman who was very, very important. Whoever this person was, by whose body I was in, this woman was tremendously important. Suddenly, I felt like crying. I had like a fear of terror. I could feel myself welling up. I could want to cry. And I thought, how foolish. I don't even know who this person is. Well, about a second or two later, the recorder I brought along clicked off. We'd been an hour there. Clicked off, and I opened my eyes, and that was it. And the regression is over.
How did you feel when you left the hypnotist? You felt very obsessed, didn't you, with that life?
I felt very foolish, to tell you the truth, because I had been so sure. Number one, I was positive that I couldn't have been hypnotized. And then I felt kind of foolish. I've been sitting there for the last, probably half hour, 35 minutes, babbling all this stuff and about these various things I'd seen. But they were so vivid at the moment. You couldn't help but get enthused about it because everything was so vivid and so clear. And at the time, after I came out, I really felt kind of foolish. I didn't know what to do. Because Dr. Griffith said, okay, can you see how these events relate to your present life? And truly, I couldn't at the moment. I was really just befuddled. I didn't know what this meant. I just wanted to get out of there. So I basically just made some story. I don't know. I have to think about it. It's not clear now. So I basically wanted to just get out of there. So I left and went out and set my car. I sat there maybe a half hour trying to figure out what the hell just happened. It wasn't the fact that I'd been hypnotized. Okay. I mean, I didn't think it happened. Okay. The really problem with me was the clarity of the vision. They were just as clear as looking in every day. Looking, I could see line. I like in the painting, I could see every brushstroke of that painting of the hunchback woman. I could taste salt water. I could smell the odor in the cave. It was just so realistic and vivid to me. It really bothered me. I didn't know what it meant. I mean, the thing is, it'd been all blurry and you hadn't seen much. You just think it's just hypnotism, don't mean nothing. This one had been so vivid and so clear. It really bothered me. Finally, I sat there for a while, and finally, I just said, "Nah, this is stupid, Bob. It's just memories from this life that are buried in your subconscious mind. Your subconscious mind just dredged up these old memories and remodeled, refocused them into a story. That's all it is." So I try to tell myself that. That's all it is. Don't worry about it, Bob. So I went home and tried. And so I said, "Just forget about it. Go on with your life." But it's funny. I really couldn't. Because I couldn't stop thinking about this. And for the first couple of years after regression, if I closed my eyes, I could still see the paintings, especially the painting, I could just vividly. I could see, close my eyes and see every brushstroke still for at least a couple of years after. I could see the scenes were just all so vivid. And it really started bugging me because I would think about it constantly, think about the regressions constantly. And it got to the point where I'd think about it 50, 100 times a day. I'd think about it. I'd be sitting somewhere. You're supposed to be concentrating on something. Instead, you'd be thinking about this. And it got to the point I was starting to worry about it because I was thinking, gee, Bob, you're getting obsessed with this. Let it go. And I kept telling myself, just let it go, Bob. It's not important. It's nothing. It's nothing supernatural, nothing otherworldly. It's just your subconscious mind. But no matter how much I kept trying to tell myself, I couldn't stop thinking about these things, especially the paintings. Because they, again, I think, where would I see these? Because I'm not really a big art fan. I don't really know that much about art. I don't go that many exhibits, or I've been to art museums and all, but I don't really follow art that much to know anything. I wonder, where could you have seen these paintings in his life? I figured I must have seen them somewhere, and it was obviously a little blurb or something about the artist, and that's how you got the information about him. That has to be it. So I kept trying to tell myself, just forget it, Bob, forget it. But I couldn't. It never, it didn't get any better, it got worse. So finally, and believe me, in police work, I've dealt with people who have been obsessed, and I know that having a really deep obsession is not good for you. It's not. It almost always ends in trouble for you. If you're a really obsessed person or something, it doesn't usually end well. So anyway, so I say, well, you know what I need to do? You need to find one, either the still life or the Hunchback Woman painting. If I find them, then I'll say, oh, yeah, that's where I saw them at. You know, I saw them 10 years ago someplace. So I figured that's the only way I could stop this. I'd see them. I remember where it was. Then that's it. It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. So I've been a detective for a lot of years. And so I thought, well, I'll just do, you know, what's the easiest thing to do? Go to the public library, go through their art books. I mean, how many paintings of Hunchback Women could there be? And I figured it had to be half-ass famous, or I wouldn't even have, you know, known about it. How would I know about it? I'm not a big art fan. So I figure I'll find the paintings that are even the still life I saw over the fireplace. I'll find them, and then I'll know exactly, you know, okay, that's where I saw that type thing. But so I went to the library. Now, this was in 1992. This is pre-internet days. Nowadays, you just put the information in a search engine and look for it. Well, in those days, when you did research, you had to go to the library and pull books off the shelf. So I went to the public library. Now, I found out a dismaying fact to start off with. And that public library had hundreds of art books. But I sit down, I had a yellow pad so I could write the title of each book I looked through so I wouldn't do any doubling back. And I went there every day for lunch hour for several months. And I finally went through every single book and didn't find it. I couldn't find either one of the paintings. And I'm thinking, man, come on, Bob. You couldn't have just dreamed this stuff up. They were too clear. It's too vivid. I thought they dreamed up. Somehow, yes, there could be the paintings. So what I find, then after I did all of them in the library, I started visiting bookstores around, they have newer art books. I started going to visit them in search of a painting. I didn't find it. Then I started visiting some art galleries and described the paintings to them. Now, again, this was pre-internet days. So in those days, in order to find a specific painting, you had to know who the artist was and very likely what art gallery had the painting. There was no central listing in those days of paintings. You just had to call around art dealers and see if they knew about it. And I visited a dozen galleries or so. Nobody had ever heard of either painting. They didn't. They really didn't. So now it's really starting to bug me. So what I figured maybe you need to find out what happened during the hypnosis. So what happened to you, maybe I'll explain it. So I went to a New Age store here in Indianapolis and bought a couple of books about past life regression to see if maybe that would explain what happened. In one of them, I found a really good script in the back that basically had faulty self-hypnosis, and it sounded very similar to Dr. Griffith's way of doing it. And so I tried that, but believe me, that's not harder than you think. Self-hypnosis is a lot harder than you think. Only two different times, probably did it maybe 10 times. Twice, I could see myself going into the same state I was in Dr. Griffith's office, the hypnotic state, you would feel it. But it wouldn't last for a second or two. I'd see the number 1917. It'd be like a big pop, and it was done. Twice, I saw the number 1917. I didn't know if this was an address, an amount of money, or what it was, just 1917. But finally, I looked at everything I'd done, and I couldn't think of anything else to do. I really didn't. I thought, what else can you do, Bob? Because in Indianapolis, when I was in charge of the homicide branch at the Indianapolis Police Department, we had an 83% clearance rate, which is very exceptional for a city our size to have an 83% clearance rate. That still means that 17% of your murders every year go unsolved. There are cases you just can't solve. There's no evidence. And I figured that's what's going to happen in this case. You know, there's nowhere else to look, no one else to talk to. Just give it up. And so I decided right then, well, I'm just going to put it on the shelf. Well, what we do with like a homicide case, if you don't solve it after enough time, you simply deactivate it. But that doesn't mean you don't close the case and forget about it. You keep it deactivated. But if any new evidence comes along in the future, reactivate it and bring it out. And that's why I thought, well, this case, there's nothing more I can do. So I So I said, well, Bob, there's no point in thinking about it, no point in worrying about it, because you can't do anything. So that didn't last. That didn't work, though. I kept thinking about it and kept seeing these different, you know, scenes in the regression. But anyway, a couple months later, it was getting to be my wife and my anniversary, the last of April, and we were thinking about going. We weren't going to go vacation somewhere. We wanted to go somewhere neither of us had ever gone to. And so my wife would call me one day at work and say, let's go to New Orleans. Now, I'd never been to New Orleans, and neither did she. That's like fun. So we made arrangements to go to New Orleans, and we went there, and it was fun. We had a great time there. My wife's a big history buff, and boy, in New Orleans, you can't turn around without bumping into something historical. And she dragged me all over the area, visiting plantations and battlefields and all that. But anyway, at nighttime, we go down to the French Quarter and listen to the bands and everything. But interesting enough, every night we go down to the French Quarter, you notice walking through towards it, there are lots of neat little shops in the French Quarter that sold antique stores and memorabilia stores and all that. So but they were always closed because we go there late at night to go down to the bars, hear the music and everything. So anyway, our last day in New Orleans, our plane didn't leave by 8 p.m. And I still, my wife, why don't we go window shopping in the French Quarter? Well, we've got the whole day before our plane leaves. Let's go window shopping. And so we did. We went to visit a bunch of antique stores and memorabilia stores, what have you. Anyway, we finally got to Royal Street. Now, back in 1993, Royal Street was all art galleries. And so we started looking in there, and they had some beautiful paintings. I mean, the big art galleries had some gorgeous, beautiful paintings. As we're walking down the street, I'm noticing the galleries are getting smaller, and the paintings more, and the painters more obscure. So we're walking down Royal Street, and we finally get to the end of the street. There's a little gallery there. We go in. There's a sign that says Modern Art Upstairs. Now, I've never been a fan of modern art. I never have liked it much. My wife is, though, so she goes up the stairs to see the modern art. I'm just walking downstairs along the wall, walking and looking at the paintings hanging on the walls. So I'm walking along. I don't recognize any of the painters or any of the paintings. These are very obscure painters and very obscure paintings. And I'm walking along. There's a portrait sitting on an easel in the corner. And I'm just looking at the painting. I walk by, and I give it a glance and start to turn. And it's like I hit it, walk into a glass wall. And I turn back around. It was a painting of the Hunchback Woman. Now, let me tell you something. As a police officer, I've been in lots of scary situations. I've been in lots of situations where, don't kid yourself, it's scary. I mean, people think you're police is brave, just brazen, go into places. No, a lot of times you're scared. But I had never been as scared as I was this moment. But I look at that and I thought, what's the odds? Come on, what's the odds that I could dream this up in my imagination, search for it for months, not find it, and just stumble onto an accident in New Orleans? But at first, I told myself, no, Bob, this looks like the painting. That's all it is. It looks like it's not it. But I closed my eyes, and I could see by the painting and the regression, stroke for stroke. And I opened my eyes, and that it was the painting. It was the painting of Hunchback Woman. Again, I'm trying to think, there's got to be an explanation for this. I'm sitting there thinking, am I really not here? Am I really in a nursing home somewhere where, I've got tubes up my nose and hooked to machines, and this is all big imagination? Because I'm trying to find some rational explanation. How is this possible? Police officers don't believe in coincidences. We really don't. But we most often find when it was a major, a large coincidence investigation, it's not a coincidence. It's simply something someone did to make it look like coincidence. But even that thought kind of startled me, because you'd think, well, who could do this to make this happen? And I didn't know what to do. The thing about police work is there's a lot of danger in police work. There certainly is. But you're trained to have a handle it. You have experience of previous instance of a very similar instance, so you know what to do. So it takes a lot of the scariness out of it because you know what to do. But in this case, I had no training, no experience. I had no idea what to do. I just stood there staring. I had no idea what to do. I mean, come on, these things, they might happen on the X-Files. They might happen in movies. These things don't happen to people in real life. This doesn't happen. I stood there for probably 5 minutes staring at the painting. I had no idea what to do. Finally, one of the salesmen in the store come up, saw me staring at it, come up, and he says, I bet you think how nice to look over your fireplace. I've been at the moment thinking, yeah, sort of want a picture of a Hunchback Woman I don't know about fireplace. But anyway, I told him, I said, who's the painter? I said, I don't recognize the artist. Who's the artist? He said, hang on a second, I got a little bio over here. So I went over and he did his old desk. He went on to do his files. He finally found his little bio. It's just a short little paragraph. It said the man's name was J. Carroll Beckwith. And I looked at his date of birth, day of death. It said 1852 to 1917. And I remember thinking that my attempt at self-regression. I thought, no, that's again, it's just a coincidence, same thing. And I read the short bio and immediately confirmed five of the things I'd seen during regression. That there, number one, that there was a paying hunchback woman, the 1917. And I found the artist had lived in the 1800s. I thought the regression I'd taken was taken by 1800s. It had. And during the time, during my one of my bar regression, Dr. Griffin asked me where we were. And I told her I thought we were in France. I don't know. I just blurted out. I don't know why. Well, it then the thing that he had been, he had studied art school in France. And also that he won some awards for his painting. And I remember the party I was at where everybody congratulated me. But again, time I'm thinking, so Bob, be right. There's a rational explanation to this. Don't get carried away on this. Okay, there's got to be a rational explanation. So anyway, I thought, he said, would you be interested in paying? I can give it to you at a reasonable price. They wanted $5,000 for it. There was no way I was going to pay $5,000 for a painting. I was still sure I had seen in this life somewhere. I was still certain that I'd seen it. But I did think at that moment, well, Bob, you've got enough information now. You can take this case off the shelf, go back to Annapolis, check up on who this J. Carroll Beckwith was. You'll then remember where you saw that painting. So anyway, I left the art store and he said, I'm not going to fork out $5,000 for a painting, then find out, gee, I saw that 10 years ago on that, you know, at an art gallery somewhere. So anyway, I had this new information, so I went back home and I went back to the public library. Again, this is pre-internet days. And so, but I found something very dismaying. There was very, very, very little information about J. It actually, the J stands for James. There's very little information about James Carroll Beckwith. In the small books on artists, there's nothing. In the large ones, you'll have maybe two or three sentences. Basically, just said he was a portrait painter who lived in New York City in the early 1900s. But he never painted any masterpiece paintings. He basically made most of his living painting people's portraits. But how could I know all this about him? He's that obscure and that, you know, type of painter. How could I know this information about him? So anyway, there wasn't very much information at all, except I also confirmed some more things that happened to him. I found he died in October, and I said during the regression, I saw myself flying through woods, and it looked like late fall. And he did die in the fall. And also, I said I'd come over a large city. When after I died, I came over through the building top. Well, he died in New York City. And also, I said that I'm painting portraits. I hate painting portraits. Well, the information at the bottom there said he'd made his living painting portraits, but he hated doing it most of his life. But he painted because he needed the money. So anyway, now I'm really getting flustered because there's hardly information about him at all. He was tremendously obscure. But I kept confirming one teeny little bits of this regression. So finally, the librarian at the Indianapolis Public Library says, you need to go up to the art museum library. So they have a much better, art library than we do here. Go visit them. They can have more information on you, about you. So I did. So I went up to the art museum library. And they did have a little more, but not a lot. That when everything they had, the library collected, they probably filled maybe half a page at the most. That's all they could find on. But interesting enough, the layer did tell me at the Art Museum Library, we, by the way, have a folder of an exhibition of Beckwith's birth that's held in Annapolis. At the moment, I felt this tremendous feeling of relief wash on me. Yes, that's where I saw it. They had an exhibition of his work in Annapolis. That's where I saw that. All of a sudden, you feel this real cool relief. Everything's explained. Except when I opened the folder, I found that the exhibition was in 1911. It was a terrible disappointment after all that joy and relief. It came a terrible disappointment. And I asked the lady, this is the last one? She said, look, he wasn't very famous and he really wasn't that good. But interesting enough, at the library, there's nothing found at the library. I found one of them had a little footnote on it. Said this information came from the diaries of James Carroll Beckwith, now on file at the National Academy of Design in New York City. So I thought, there it is. That's what I need to do. I need to look at his diaries. Maybe that will explain it. Maybe I can find it. Because at this time, I was starting to get desperate this time because I had probably this time, I had found probably 10 confirmations of things I'd seen during the regression. It was really starting to unsettle me a bit because I still didn't believe this was anything supernatural and otherworldly, but I couldn't realize, how do I know so much about this man who was a nobody? He was just an ordinary painter who never did anything famous. But how would you know this about him? So anyway, I went home and I drew up a letter to the National Academy of Design, asking if it's possible to see his diaries, to read his diaries. But so I mailed it off. After I mailed it off, I got my tape out again of the regression, and I sat down and wrote down all the things could be proved about Beckway, one way or the other. Because I found there were 28 things I had said or seen during the regression that could be proven, yes or no. This time I found I'd already proven 10, but they were not big things. I mean, a lot of people died in 19, probably millions of people died in 1917. A fourth of people die in the fall of the year. Awful people die in big cities. This is not enough to sway either way, I thought. So what I was telling you, what I really wanted to find, I wanted to find one thing about the regression that wasn't true. In other words, for example, I had told Dr. Griffith that my wife, I would regret not having children, but my wife couldn't have children. So Beckwith had three or four kids, and this is not real. This is not true. This is some kind of mishmash or something, but it's not real because you wouldn't make a mistake about that life like that. I was hoping to find one or maybe two things that weren't real. If I could find one of these 28 things, if I could find just a couple were real, then I could just write it off. I said, nah, this is not real. This is something. There's something else. Now, maybe, I don't want to be, but at least I'd explain it. So anyway, I finally got a letter back from the National Academy of Design about 2 weeks later. They said, we're sorry, because the diaries are very old, very fragile, they don't loan them out. However, they said, they have been microfilmed. And you could get a copy of the microfilm through the Archives of American Art to the Smithsonian. So I went back to the library and had an interlibrary loan to get the microfilm diaries. And so I'm waiting anxiously on these because, again, I'm looking for something. I'm looking for some rational explanation for this. I knew there had to be some rational explanation for all this. I just couldn't see what it was at that moment. So anyway, they finally called me at the library and said, hey, your microfilm's here. Come in. So I went in, take a look at it. I found another very distressing fact. Beckwith had started his diary at age 20. I think he was 19, just probably maybe 20. And he was a very faithful diary keeper. He made diary entries to the day before he died at 65. There was 17,000. It was on 9 spools, 17,000 pages. So yeah, now I'm flustered. What do you do now? That would take, how long take to read that? And I could only keep these spools for 2 weeks and I had to send them back. So anyway, I found out also that he had, besides that, the archives of Eric Art told me that besides his diaries, he also had an autobiography that he had written. And I thought, great, I'll just look at that one. That should explain things. Unfortunately, he started in the spring of 1917. He died of endocarditis, which part of the symptom of endocarditis makes you very tired. So he was getting very tired. He couldn't stand up to paint at all. Maybe he started his diary in that spring, but he only had 23 pages done. He only went up to age 21. So that wasn't much help. So if I decided what I'd do is I would just sample the diaries, just take a little each, just look at each diary, see if I could find, just sample a couple pages out each year. But then I found, for some reason, he had typed up part of the diary. It was about a trip. He was in art school in France, and during the summer, when the school was out, he took a trip to Venice. And he said that in Venice, he lived on burnt eggs and wine. And I remember one of the things I'd said to Dr. Griffith, I ordered a glass of wine. I thought that might be one of the factors. So I didn't think that in the late 1800s, men drank whiskey. They drank wine. As a matter of fact, he mentioned in his diary that people considered a little odd his taste for wine, but he said he developed that while living in France. So finally, I kept finding these little things. I kept finding each one's a little more confirmation. So anyway, at the end of 2 weeks, I had to send them back because I couldn't think of what else to do. So I've also figured it's about time to get my wife involved in this. She's a police detective too, and she really needs to know what I'm doing. Because I've been spending a lot of time at the library, and I wasn't really producing any. At that time, I was writing articles and short stories. I wasn't producing any of them. And so I finally told my wife what I was doing. And she didn't know until that time anything about this. And her response was not what I expected. She thought I was crazy. She thought I was nuts. And I tried to, now listen, let me explain what happened. I explained it all to her, what happened. I said, how do you explain it? She said, you read something about him. You've seen it in the movie or read the book. And I tried to explain to her, there are no books about Beckwith, there are no movie about him. He was nobody, not that famous. So she says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go find it. I'll go find the information. Now, I really was glad to hear her say that. It was kind of one of the reasons I told her I wanted her to do this, because I was looking for a second opinion of mine. One of my biggest admonishments when I was the commander of homicide, my biggest admonishment to my officer was, do not get emotionally involved in your cases. But that gives you tunnel vision. If you get emotionally involved in your cases, you get tunnel vision. You can't see things you ought to see because you're so involved in it. Well, I knew I was really involved, emotionally involved in this case. Now, I was going against my own advice. So I wanted a third party, an impartial third party, to look in and check my work to see if maybe I'd overlooked something. Maybe I was seeing the importance of things that weren't there or not seeing something. So my wife told me, okay, I'll look into it. I'll find it. Well, she did about a month, and she didn't find a single thing more than I did. She couldn't find a thing. But even so, she kept telling me, Bob, I don't care. Shut up about it. This is not what police captains talk about. They don't go talk. They don't go blabbing that they believe in past lives. Don't. At the time, I thought, well, that might be good advice. I don't know. Maybe I need to follow. It might be really good advice. And so I thought maybe I would. I said maybe I just need to forget about it. You're right. This wouldn't do my career any good. And so I set the tapes back, and I thought, well, I'm not going to do it. And interesting enough, I started to get back and writing articles. I was writing for Police Management Magazine at that time. And I was doing an article on line of duty deaths in police departments, how small police departments could handle line of duty deaths. So I'm talking to another police captain I knew, who I knew that she had been the first officer at the scene of a police officer. We had a police officer killed just recently. I knew this captain, she had been the first officer at the scene. So I went to interview her about it for the article in my magazine. And the funny thing, we were just talking, and all of a sudden she talked about this out-of-body experience she had. I said, Say what? But she said, when I ran up to the body, I could see he was dead. He'd been shot in the chest with a shotgun. She said she knew he was dead, but she was still trying to, see if he had any signs of life at all. I suddenly realized, I don't know where the shooter's at. Shooter piece right behind me, ready to shoot me. And she said, at that moment, she said, I felt myself leave my body. He said, I'm seeing the scene from above. I'm just watching what's happening from above. I thought that was kind of bizarre. The interesting part was she told her without any kind of feelings of embarrassment or anything. She goes, she said, that's what happened. So I thought that was kind of, I never heard anything like that before. So about a week later, so I was in federal court, and of course they had separated the witnesses. So me and some other police officers were sitting in a room waiting to testify to this trial. And another police captain was there, and we were just talking. And he talked about this one time that he and his partner were at a certain location, and a guy come run in and say, hey, there. So guys holding up the grocery store next door. So him and his partner run over to the grocery store, and there, sure enough, there was a bunch of guys in there holding up with the guns. Well, he ran in the door, and of course, the guy yelled, hey, there's a cop, kill him. So they got into a big gun battle. And he told them the story about they got back, they retreated back in the parking lot, and they were shooting each other, and he had out-of-body experience. This came out of nowhere, and I had never heard anybody talk about this sort of thing before. And he told about how he all of a sudden he saw himself above the parking lot, and he could see himself shooting at these guys, them shooting at him. And he said at the moment he thought he had died and that his body and soul was trying to see what happened, how he got killed. But he said then in a short time he went back to his body and they ended up arresting the rest of the guys and everything. So then I said, wait, this is silly. How come this is the first time I ever heard these stories before? So I started making kind of discreet inquiries on police department, people who'd had these kind of paranormal events. I found something really interesting. An awful lot of police officers have had paranormal events. Most of them always happened during times of intense stress, very intense stress. But I found an awful lot of policemen had them. And they didn't seem embarrassed to talk about it. At that moment, I said, well, man, but these guys can talk about it. I certainly can. I really can. So what I did, I said, I'm not going to hide this thing. Nobody on this is not that unusual, police officers. So I went back, I reordered the spools of the microfilm, and I had hard copies made of the diary, all 17,000 pages. And I basically read the whole thing. I read all 17,000 pages. Again, it took me over a year to do this, because Beckwith sometimes used pencil and sometimes he scribbled in his diary, and it was really tough. But the interesting thing, I kept again, I'm still looking for these little, one big discrepancy or two discrepancies, but I never could find them. I never could. I kept finding, instead you kept finding one more and more. For example, he talked about his, October 24th, 1988, which incidentally is interesting, it was 24 years to the day before he died. His wife, Bertha, had a very difficult miscarriage, and because of that, they couldn't have children. In his diary, he talks about how he'd always wanted children, but that he didn't have one because his wife couldn't have children. Again, something I'd said in the during the regression. And I thought, yeah, again, what another thing, what do you think? I found out, I saw himself with a very fancy walk stick. He talked several times in his diary about having fancy walk, but he can get having one or someone giving him a present one. I kept adding up and adding up. I just kept adding more confirmations. But finally, what happened is I finally got to December 5th, 1886 in his diary. Now, I had said at the very last of the regression, she died of a blood clot. Somebody said the doctor said she died of a blood clot. And I didn't know who they were talking about. But I knew it had to be a woman very important to him. Well, by this time, I said to Beckwith, no, there's only two women that fit that, his mother or his wife. He loved his wife, but he also loved his mother. His mother had been the only one supporting him, but he'd always wanted to be an artist from a young age, wanted to be an artist. His dad was a retail grocer. His dad expected him to join him in the retail grocery business. Beckwith wanted to be an artist. His mother is the one who bought him his first easel and paints and all. His dad always said that's the best way you do to starve to death, being an artist. But his mother encouraged him. He just dearly loved his mother. So anyway, I finally got to the December 5th, 1886 in diary, and he tells his mother was in church that morning and died of a stroke caused by blood clot. I think that was probably what it threw me over the edge. I realized then, Bob, you're not going to find it. You're not going to find it, because I didn't. I eventually it proved all 28 things. I described the doctor by a studio there and have wooden wall windows and a big skylight. When his diary, Beckwith talks about his studio being one wall windows, big skylight. And just basically, I end up finally proving all 28 facts. And then, of course, then comes the problem. What do you do? What do you do with it once you found it?
How did you feel? Was it a real shock to your system?
Yeah. Well, you know, the hardest part wasn't what I found. I proved it. Okay. The hardest part is accepting what it means. Okay. Now, Bob, you've proven this was actually a man's life. And you prove it. Now, you might be able to find things on person about Beckwith. You can find his date of death, all that. You're not going to find what his mother died of a blood clot. That's not going to record anywhere. Beckwith simply wasn't that important, that famous. There's no books about him, no magazine articles about him, nothing. You're not going to know what his mother died of. You're just not. You're not going to know, what his studio looked like. You're not going to know, these various things, all 28 facts. You're not going to know them. My problem was, you accept this. This was actually a man's life. And you were apparently somewhere in your subconscious mind. But the thing is, what does it mean? What it basically means is you've been wrong your whole life. I've been wrong my whole life. All my concepts of what reality was, of what life was, were wrong. And so I had to rethink them. I had to rethink everything. This would completely change your book. That's not an easy thing to do, to just basically say, Bob, you've been wrong your whole life. Now, all these people you kind of rolled your eyes at and snickered at who believed this sort of thing, they were right and you were wrong. And you have to come to a whole new realization of what life is about. And it's not what you thought it was. To me, that was the hardest part. It took me a while before I could finally just basically say, okay, this is what life is. Not what life you thought it was. Life is different than you thought it was. That was a really hard thing to do.
And do you feel that you're more spiritual now? Beforehand, were you a complete atheist with no belief in life after death?
I really wasn't terribly spiritual for it. I really never gave much thought to it. Now, I was raised in a Methodist family. We went to church every Sunday, but I never really was a really hardcore true believer type thing. I was more a person wanting proof. Of course, religion, there's no proof. You have to accept everything on faith. I was never really good at doing this. I was never good at accepting things on faith. I want proof. Well, here I had it now. And it turns you into not so much spiritual, but you understand things a little better because, you think about the world being unfair. And the world seems, if you think you only got one life, the world looks very unfair. I mean, because there's a lot of people who go through life, never have anything bad happen to them. They have a very couple of life, live a couple of life and die. Other people have a life of total misery. Do you think, where's the fairness in that? But you realize if it's just each life is just one small blip, it's very fair because everybody gets the chance to be a Donald Trump and everybody gets a chance to be an untouchable in Calcutta. So it's not that one person may have a great in this life, but the next life it may be a total misery life. So life is fair. Everybody gets the chance, everyone. So the things that looked really unfair about one single life, you realize they probably were, but not in the overall scheme because you get different lives and different circumstances. So to me, it made life look very much more fair than it was before.
Do you have dreams about that past life?
You're thinking that. Now, I don't think I didn't put my book because it sounded like it's too hard to sell. I had so many coincidences, so many things happen, and about during when I was writing the book, just one bizarre coincidence after another. It's really strange. A lot of things happen. For example, several times when I was going to write this, my wife was dead set against me not writing this. She said, "Bob, this is going to ruin your career. It's going to kill your career," and she was right. But anyway, a couple of times I had decided, yep, she's right. I'm going to call my agent, send the money back, and forget about going to the other wedding. Each time I did that, something bizarre, really bizarre. For example, I was talking to my wife, and I decided one day, okay, that's it. I'm not going to do it. That very same day, I got a call from the Berry Hill Gallery in New York City. And Leigh there was a researcher for him. She said, "I understand you're doing research on Beckwith." I found the art was very small, and I had done a lot of calling, visiting galleries and asking about Beckwith paintings and everything. But she didn't know why I was doing it. And she said, "I understand you're researching Beckwith." I said, "Yeah, I am." And she wanted to know if I knew where his paintings were in private collections. They were holding an exhibition of his work at this gallery and wanted to find where his paintings at. And I thought, why? Why would you want to exhibition Beckwith's work? And this was it turned out to be a very upscale, very nice upscale gallery. Why? And she said, "I don't know." She said, "It came a couple of years ago, and so we thought it could be a good idea." So interesting. I went to New York while it was going on to see the paintings and all that. I found a really interesting fact. This exhibition went on for 30 days. They didn't sell a single, but not one painting. They didn't sell a single painting in 30 days. The truth is, he's simply not that good. He's competent. If you were a person who wanted a painting made, a portrait, but didn't want to pay a lot of money, he could make a competent portrait of you. It'd be okay, but it wasn't anything. No, you're nowhere near. Because interesting enough, he was a roommate in art school and a good friend with John Singer Sargent, who was probably next to William, probably next to Whistler, probably the most famous American painter ever. They were friends. At that time, he charged $25,000 to paint a portrait. Beckwith charged $1,000 or less, usually less. So if you could pay the $25,000 to have Singer do it, or you could pay $1,000 to Beckwith. There's a difference in talent between the two. Beckwith simply wasn't that talented. And so, it's just one of the things that he was just a very, very obscure person that nobody really knew anything about him. They really didn't. Before, like I said, before the internet, nobody knew anything about him. Now you can find him on the internet because there's so many search engines about painters and all that. Before that, you simply couldn't find him.
Do you own any of the paintings?
No, I don't. And there's a reason for that, too, because I didn't want the people to look like, he wrote the book just to try and up the price of his paintings. You hope to give him some publicity. Because the interesting thing, I found one thing about paintings, any kind of publicity for paintings is good. Because I wanted to use some of Beckwith's paintings in my book, and the original, not the second edition came out, the original edition came out in 1999, and they had a number of his portraits in it. Several people allowed me to do it for free just so they could say this painting had been in a book. That increased the price of the painting, apparently. Just any there's no bad publicity for paintings. Any publicity at all increases their prices. And so I had several galleries would allow me to do it for free. The museums don't do that. They charge you to use your paintings in your book. A number of galleries said, yeah, and so, but you have to mention what galleries is at and all that. And so they would increase the painting. So I didn't want people to think, you're just writing the book to increase the value of the paintings. No, I don't own any of his. Again, his paintings still don't go for a whole lot of money. They're not that good. They're simply not that. They're competent, okay, but they're not anywhere near a great painting. So they don't really go for any kind of, they still go for any kind of big money. Again, that one gallery, the Berry Hill Gallery, didn't sell a single one.
Do you feel that you might have brought anything through from Carol Beckwith's personality to this life?
I don't think so, because Beckwith was really a whiny person. If you read his diary, my God, he whines constantly about money. He don't have enough money. He needs to make more money. He can't get enough port. And actually, interesting enough, toward the end of his life, he was actually pretty well off. He really was. But he was a whiny. I wouldn't want to think I was like him because you read his diary, you see, he was just, he never felt he was that good a painter. He never felt he could reach the height he should have reached, that he wasn't that good. And it really bugged him. But most of the stuff he's whining about needed money type thing. And I guess enough, he could never have enough. He had an uncle who died in 1880s, I think it is, and left him $10,000. Now, that don't sound like a lot of money now. In 1880s, $10,000 is a whole lot of money. But Beckwith wasn't happy. He thought he should have got more. I mean, this is an uncle. And Beckwith was kind of upset because the uncle left most of the money to his wife and daughter. You know, you think, Lucia, he was just upset that he only got 10,000 of it. He could never get enough money. And I wouldn't want to think I was that way either. Beckwith was not a terribly engaging person. He really wasn't. He had a lot of personality defects. I would hope I didn't carry him forward. I'd hope I'd better let you. You'd learn something from him.
Can you tell us about when you visited Beckwith's grave?
After finishing the book, I found out Beckwith in his diaries had said a number of times, "I'm working on my scrapbook and I work my scrapbooks." And I couldn't find out where his scrapbook. Nobody seemed to know where his scrapbook is at. But anyway, I had found one of Beckwith's paintings in an art magazine. So I called the gallery. They had the painting, I was searching for the information. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what. So let me speak. I got an expert on American art that I use." I didn't realize apparently there's a lot of fraud in American art. There's an awful lot of fraud going on. He makes her authenticate these paintings. So talk to her. She would know more about this and everything. So I'm talking to her, and I didn't ask her anything. Just out of the blue, said, "You know his scrapbooks are at the New York Historical Society, right?" And I did. He just came out of the blue. And so I knew that he had made scrapbooks, and I knew I couldn't finish the book. You couldn't finish the investigation without, I'd read all 17,000 pages of the diary, but you still couldn't finish the investigation without looking. This is a major piece of evidence, without going and seeing them. So I made a trip to New York City because it is the historical society, and looked at the scrapbooks. He had 8 or 9 of them, but really I didn't find anything in there that I didn't already know. Didn't find much in there. Mostly it was just supplementing what I knew already. But anyway, during the investigation, I had found in one of the art books in Beckwith, Who's Who in American Art, it listed his death as a suicide. Now I knew that wasn't true. Because I didn't hint any question about it. And I knew that he'd been sick the last of his life. They put his death down as suicide. And so I said, "No, that can't be right." But I thought, I'd check it out, see if it was. So I called the New York City medical examiner. At that time, I was still commander of the homicide branch. And I told him, "This is Captain Robert Snow, the homicide branch." And I told him I wanted to check on the cause of death of a person. He said, "Okay, no problem." So I told him what it was and when he died. And he'd think he'd ask. I was surprised he never asked why I care about somebody who died in 1917. He didn't ask. He said, "Oh, hang on." He said, I'll let you know. I'll call you tomorrow, let you know." So he called me back the next day, and he'd actually pulled out the death certificate and everything, because there'd been autopsies, because he died kind of suddenly. But they found out he died of endocarditis, which is an infection of the heart valves, not suicide. And he actually sent me a copy. So he said, "You want that copy of the death certificate?" I said, "Yeah." Which, this is one of the benefits by being a police captain. I don't think if you'd been ordering assistance, I don't doubt you get this kind of cooperation. But the medical examiner is very, very nice. So he sent me a copy of Beckwith's death certificate. Well, it said that he had been buried at Kensico Cemetery. So I looked up where it was at. It's up north. It's in Valhalla, New York, which is a northern suburb of New York City. So while I was in New York City looking up the scrapbooks, I also tried to find the sites where Beckwith lived and worked. They were all gone. Everything had been built over, new buildings, everything. Well, I had one last day there. I decided, it'd be kind of cool to visit your own grave. And I thought, this one might be kind of fun. So the last day I caught a train out of Grand Central Station and went up to Valhalla, New York, and went to Kensico Cemetery. And it's a beautiful cemetery, but it's huge. It's a huge cemetery, but very, very beautiful cemetery. So I went to the office and got a map, and she showed me where Beckwith's grave was at. So it was a very nice autumn day, so I decided to walk there. They offered to give me a lift. I thought, I want to walk and kind of look at the graveyard and everything. So I walked in to the top of the hill and everything, and I found the marked place, and there it was. And the thing, when I started getting closer to the grave, when I got like 10 feet or something to the grave, I got this terrible panic reaction. Now, when I first became a police officer, now you run into a lot of scary situations you're not used to, and you have this panic because you don't know what to do, and you haven't done it before, and I always had this thing, you can feel the electricity in your arms, you're starting to sweat, and your heart's palpitating. I always had this problem, but when I got really, it was really a very scary situation, my left knee started shaking. It was shaking like crazy. But what I do in those days is just lock my knee and just go on in and take care of the situation. But I had this terrible panic reaction when I got closer to his grave. It got worse, and I remember at the time thinking, Bob, this is foolish. There's nothing to be scared of. There's just a body that's been there for years, you know, a long time, and there's no, you can write no spirits or anything. Any spirit was in him is in you, so there can't be any spirits here. I can understand this is foolish, but I no matter how I tried to tell myself, I could not. I had a terrible, terrible panic attack at the grave. I could not stop it. It was just knees shaking, sweat, my heart palpitating, and I thought, well, I got what I got to do. I got to prove not scared. So I seen the people working on some shrubbery, maybe 100 feet away. So I went over to them, and finally, once I left the grave, all went away. The panic attack went away. Once I got 10 foot or so away, it was gone. I asked one of the workers, "Would you take a picture of me at this grave? I need a picture." I said, "Sure, Jerry Pulver." So we walked back to the grave, so like he could picture me standing at the grave. And when I got about 10 feet from it, the panic attack came back. Just a tremendous, I could not stop it. It's just, again, it's just the sweating, the heart palpitating, about my knees shaking the whole time I was there. So I could not stop it. So I finally, this guy, look, it took forever, but I finally got him to take a picture. And I would have got the camera. And once I got away from him, it was gone. Now, I have no explanation for that at all. I don't know why that would be. Yeah, I know. Apparently, you're not supposed to do this. Apparently, you're not supposed to visit your own grave. Why? I have no idea. But it was just a terrible, terrible panic attack whenever I got near the grave. To me, people have asked about why. I have no explanation for that at all. I don't have a clue what had happened. Not a clue.
It's a very strange reaction, isn't it? Something psychological going on there.
Yeah, I have no. I mean, again, I kept trying to reason myself. Bob, there's nothing here. It's just a dead body and any spirit. There couldn't be spirits or ghosts here because the spirit's inside you. So I have no idea why would it be a panic attack. I've had other people ask me. Different people have different explanations, but I have none. I can't figure out why it was, other than apparently you're not supposed to do that.
Have you had another regression to examine this life?
Well, I did. During the original investigation, I could not find anything about the Beckwith. I could not, I couldn't find anything about the paintings. I was still looking to see if I could find paintings. I finally went back to Griffith for a second regression. I wanted to see if I could get more information about the artist. Maybe I could find who the artist was. This is during a time when I had the regression and I was trying to find one of the two paintings and I couldn't. I thought maybe if I went back down to Griffith, I could get more information on the artist. So I went back to her for a second session, and they all went, same thing, went into the same state of hypnosis. I had, like three or four past lives, but every time she'd ask me to go to the artist's life, nothing had happened, absolutely nothing. Every time she told me to go back to my most role-free past life, go back to the life of the artist, nothing had happened. Just nothing. And when we were done, she said, well, apparently you already know everything you need to know. Now, at the time, I didn't think so, but it turned out she was right, that, again, these other lives, like the Greek girl at the altar, like the caveman, the lives I saw during the secretion were too far back in history to be verifiable. Really, you really couldn't verify a life more than 100 years ago because nobody kept records in those days. They really didn't. Not like now, everything's computerized and it's easy to find stuff. If you get too far back in lives, unless it's a famous person, there's not going to be a record of them. And my problem is you really can't prove regression to a famous person because you could have accidentally found the information on your own. You could have found it by movies and books and stuff, so you don't really know if that's true either. The only way you could really prove a regression, the person has to be so obscure, there's no way you could have stumbled on the information about them. But on the flip side of that, people that are obscure very seldom leave information about themselves. I was very fortunate by Beckwith leaving his diaries, but in 99.9% of cases, you wouldn't be that lucky. To find a person that obscure in order to prove regression, it's a kind of double-edged sword. You have to be terribly obscure. On the other side, people that are obscure don't leave that many records themselves, so it's kind of tough.
When the book was released, how did the police department react to the publicity?
Not well. It didn't go well at all. No, it didn't. Now, here's enough. It's got to be, and tell me, kind of look at the shirt, make sure I can hear him say, I always believe that. I said, I'm the guy who did that. The chief and the chief staff did not take well to it. They really didn't. As the book got more publicity, it got worse and worse at the police department. And finally, they tried to force me. They can't. I'm a civil servant. They can't. They tried to want to force me to retire. They wanted to force me to retire. They can't. What happened is I went on to a TV show called Proof Positive about the book, and they asked me to take a lie detector test. And I actually took two of them. to prove that I wasn't lying about the book. And that, I think that didn't go well at all. That didn't go well at all to the chief of the chief staff. Like my wife had said, this is not something police captains espouse. You might believe it, fine. You don't go talk about it. You certainly go writing books about it. And so she was right. They really did it. They basically, even though I was in homicide, I had the murder rate was the lowest it'd been in like 20 years. We still had an AIDS prevention clearance rate. They moved me out of that job and put me at the citizen service desk. This is a place where people come to get fingerprinted and get photos and reports. This is a job they put captains in who are just getting ready to retire. You know, that's what they put you at when you're ready to go out the door. Well, that was the message I was supposed to get. It was time for me to retire. I didn't. I retired several years later, but I wouldn't let them make me retire. But they tried to force me into retirement. They really did. They were really very upset about it. And it stopped my career. At the time, I was on a very upward mobile path. Because being a captain of homicide is probably the most prestigious spot in the police department. It's one of those spots everybody wants, and it's really hard to get. So it's a very prestigious spot. And I was on moving up. Well, my career went to a dive after that, basically dead-ended, and I ended up retiring after a couple of years anyway. So it didn't go well at the police department at all. No, it didn't. And I knew it wouldn't. My wife knew it wouldn't. But the problem was there was just so much information here, so much I'd found so much information and so much evidence. It just felt like something, and a lot of this evidence, like the painting in New Orleans, a lot of the evidence in this case just fell in my lap. I mean, it really did. It came out of nowhere and fell in my lap. And I felt like this was too important. This really was. I had too much information, and it was too important to me to keep secret. And basically, I decided to publish a book, even though I knew it in my career, and it did. But I just felt like the book needed to be published. Again, I got too much information just dropped out of the air onto me to believe this is all just one big coincidence. And I went ahead and published it anyway, even though I knew it in my career.
Well, it seems quite brave of you to go ahead and do it. Are all the books available on Amazon?
Yeah. There's actually a second edition. I had the first book. When the first book came out in 1999, of course, I know how things would turn out, you know, with the police department, all that. And also, there were 28 facts I had found during the thing, you know, that I don't want to prove. There were two of them that were kind of on the edge thing. I couldn't really prove them, disprove them type thing. Well, after the first book came out, a couple of my readers started doing a lot of research on their own about the, and they were basically able to prove the last two facts for me. And so there's a second edition of the book called Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic. It's basically, now that's the second edition, and it's out now, and it's available at BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com, all the places.
And do you have your own website?
I don't have it. If you put my name into Amazon.com, they have a website for authors. That's the website I have. If you put Robert L. Snow into Amazon.com, it'll take you to my website with all my books on it.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, Robert, for coming on to the Past Lives podcast. It's been really fascinating. You really do tell the story very well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on your show. I really do.
In this classic episode, I was talking to Robert Snow about his book, Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, the true story of a police detective's reincarnation. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.